Liebe Freunde und Kollegen, was machen wir mit Rissen, also Cracks? Sollten wir die eher adhesiv versiegeln oder sollten wir die verfolgen und hoffen, dass sie irgendwann aufhören, bevor sie in der Pulpa landen? Das ist so eine Frage, die sich oft auch in Fortbildung stellt. Ich bin ja der Meinung, die machen manchmal so ein bisschen, was sie wollen. Wir können leider nicht so hundertprozentig vorhersagbar die stoppen. Und deshalb finde ich das Thema, das David Gedol und Stefan Broad in dem ihrem Vortrag besprechen werden, sehr spannend. Sie reden mich über Cracks auf dem GC November Symposium. Ich bin selber Referent bei dem Symposium und spreche zusammen mit Mindaugas über Direct Post Endo. Und es ist eine große Ehre, dass ich dabei sein darf. Und es ist noch viel schöner, dass ich auch mit jedem Referenten einen Podcast machen konnte, die ja alle auf dem Dental Bonding Podcast-Kanal hört. Dort sind ja nur englischsprachige Podcasts drauf. Aber ich habe mich natürlich entschieden, diese beiden coolen Zahnärzte, David und Stefan, auch auf dem deutschen Kanal auszuspielen, weil das einfach meine dentalen Helden sind. Ich habe von ihnen mich ganz viel inspirieren lassen, was Kofferdamm angeht, direkte Füllungen und natürlich auch adhesives Zementieren unter Kofferdamm. Und deshalb wünsche ich euch viel Spaß beim Hören von diesem Podcast und meldet euch bitte beim gcdentalcampus.com an, um das ganze Symposium zu verfolgen. Welcome to today's show. I'm connected to David and Stefan. It's really a pleasure to have you two on here because I just admitted you're one of my very influential dentists in my dental world. So thanks a lot. For example, when it comes to isolation, I learned a lot of from you too. I even visited a workshop when you were in Berlin, which was great. And it's great to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for having us.
We are going to have a November symposium with GC and your lecture will have to do something about cracks. And I already know a lecture by Stefan. It's years ago in Romania, very long ages ago. And it's really exciting topic. I just had this week a case of a crack. Are cracks still the same today or 5 years ago?
Well, Stefan, maybe you should start because...
Maybe I should start. Actually, the lecture has changed in the meantime, especially since we're actually working quite a lot on the topic together with David. So the approach might be different. The cracks still are the same, look the same, but we look on them maybe from a different perspective in the meantime than we did maybe 7-8 years ago because of things we know, because of things we don't know and still don't know, and also because we had also our big share of trial and error, I think, because there is a complete lack of really clear guidelines. There is a very recent, and I think you have it, Georg, the position statement of the that was published in the International Journal of Endodontics. There is a position statement about cracked teeth. So there is some, but still a lot is left to interpretation. So this is where we will try to shed some light on the issue on the symposium lecture, yes.
Actually, what I kind of tell all the dentists when they ask me is actually one thing I learned from you, Stefan, that you kind of look with the D-Line Pro if there are bacteria in the crack, and then you kind of decide if you enlarge the crack or if you just adhesively seal it.
Yeah. Exactly. I use the D-Lite Pro in different ways, actually. First, to evaluate the integrity of the tissue. So if you have very small cracks, fissures, unsupported enamel, even you can judge very clearly the integrity of the tissue because of the color response that you get using the D-Lite Pro in detection mode. But on top of that, you can use it to highlight areas that have active bacterial produce, like the porphyrins that allow you to check whether there is active bacteria in a crack line. You can just simply also detect whether there is any, I like to call it schmutz, in the crack that is left behind. So especially in combination with a plaque indicator or even with caries detector, you have a very clear view of how white a crack actually is. So if you can judge the width of a crack and its infiltration by bacteria, you have a pretty good idea whether or not you can try to seal it or have to chase it. Yeah, just stop where you ended because you reached the final limit of isolation, maybe. I don't know. So a lot of things are helpful in this detection mode, yeah.
But it's already, I think, quite an advanced process. It's pretty far in the process because I think the actual problem of the majority of us is simply to detect the presence, yes or no, of a crack, because actually it's almost like everything. If we don't look for it, we cannot find it. This is a pity, but this is like this. So this is why I think that the knowledge that we can get about cracks makes us more curious to discover the cracks. And then we understand, oh, yes, there is that crack hole. There must be a crack in there because of this and this. That indicates that most probably we have a crack growing down the cusp or something. And then once we can get used to, let's say, just discovering them, seeing them better, we can take better decisions. And for this, we have some devices like the D-Light Pro or any UV light source that can obviously change the game, really.
What I usually see when I sandblast, for example, the dentine, when I suddenly actually see cracks where I didn't see anything before, and this was actually one of my arguments for sandblasting, that the change of surface kind of reveals cracks to you wasn't aware of before.
Yeah, because it gets matte. So it's really, you have less reflection and you don't have this layer, smear layer of debris that we can have, so everything is clearer. And at the same time, maybe the sand, depending on the kind of sand, the pressure, the orientation that you are using, with or without water and spray, at the same time can just also reveal and maybe enlarge a little bit some small fissures already, even without really wanting to do then and to chase the crack at first. So it makes it more visible. So I think for a couple of years, Stefan and I agreed very much, and like a lot of people in the bioemulation group, of sandblasting the dentin. Although this is not really proved by the literature that it's a real benefit, there are still some people that will tell you, oh, it produces micro cracks in the dentin, maybe it's not so good. Well, actually, clinically speaking, it makes the things so much easier that, yes, I completely agree with you. I would go for it like systematically, no question.
When it comes to crack detections, from an endodontic point of view, we always look with our periodontal probe if there's a crack. And actually, could it be true that as soon as we find with our periodontal probe a crack, that it's basically too late for the tooth?
Well, it means it's a deep one. you mean with the perio probe when you are probing on at the gum side? So from the outside, yeah. It means radicular crack. So which already it's maybe not the best prognosis. For sure, yeah.
I mean, there are some crazy Japanese guys who kind of go to crack teeth as well and fill it all with MTA, the canals, and have some super bonding. Actually, it's even called super bond.
Yeah.
It's kind of an interesting approach, but it seems that some Japanese population are very keen on saving their teeth as well. The cases I saw online are so crazy that I wouldn't think of any typical German patients to do that.
The qualification of crazy fits very well with Japanese, actually. So we always say, oh, those crazy Japanese guys, but they are crazy good. This is true. And maybe they go very far in this, even like rebonding a separate tooth and pluck and plugging it back in the bone. So, yes, it looks crazy for us, but, what is the risk? As long as you monitor everything, I think it's, why not, you know? If it will be my tooth, I would like to try it, but depends also on the patient. And it's not only the dentist side. We can have ideas as dentists, and maybe the patient doesn't want. They say, we'll just tell you, hey, come on, the less I see you, the best I feel. So please, I'm here today. You fix my problem, done. And for this patient, the solution is implant. That's it. So I think We have such a range of different treatment depending on what we know of our personal skills and preferences and practice and experience, but also about what the patient, what kind of treatment he would like to receive, how much he can get involved in the treatment. It does change so much. This is why I think we have different ideas, different kind of treatments that we see everywhere. It can be completely justified. Each of them can be completely fine and really good. It's very difficult to tell, well, this is the treatment that we should do for this kind of crack. Just proposals, and let's discuss with the patient and the aptitude of the day of the dentist.
The attitude of the day is probably quite important. I guess there are probably days where I feel more experimental, but maybe if I just got a recall where everything failed, I feel less experimental. Although I don't like the word experimental because there's nothing new on the world. You either can try to save the tooth or not. You either go for an onlay on this tooth or not. You can try to do it indirect, direct. I mean, there are a lot of ways to kind of approach this. Maybe we should talk about your try and error as well. Are there things you wouldn't recommend for now?
Stefan?
I wouldn't be, but this is more like a general approach. I wouldn't be too keen on being very positive in prognosis with vertical crack components. And this is the reason for this is that the element that mostly created failure in the end was the bacterial component, where you have no control whether or not bacteria in the end will infiltrate the tooth and will infiltrate along a vertical crack line and create bone loss. I think we're pretty apt and pretty good in the biomechanical approach of things, in distributing forces differently, in making decisions about cuspal coverage. So I can pretty much with confidence tell the patient, we can do a lot to prevent your tooth from breaking, but I'm not very positive on giving you any guarantees about will bacteria in the end get in this crack line and continue to, you know, mutilate things even more. So that's my personal experience in the thing. It's quite a general thing, but to me still helpful, especially when talking to patients and talking about prognosis. In the end, the bacteria will decide together with the host whether or not your plan fails or succeeds. So, yeah. I don't know, David, do you have anything to add in this context?
I think this is a very interesting point indeed, because, and this is why actually I was thinking to this debate between people advising to crown and then very deep margins, the cracked teeth, just, and other people that would claim that, okay, we should overlay them or maybe inlay them in a simple way, maintaining some enamel and the enamel rim and blah, blah, blah. And many people think or understood this debate or this fight between two like different schools in terms of biomechanical gain or loss. We drill more with the crown, we drill less with the overlay. So this is true, but that Stefan stated very good. I think that the biomechanical battle is pretty easy to win by overlaying the teeth or by crowning the teeth. Either the two of the treatment will be very, very efficient for this. But some people said that, okay, crowning it will just protect and isolate more or deeper the cracks, preventing some more infiltration. Well, we have no proof of that, but it can sometimes make sense. And I have to admit myself that sometimes for some kind of patient that have maybe bad hygiene or a pretty advanced situation, I would rather go for a crown, because I know that those patients, they will never floss, they will not brush. And if I have some vertical fracture at the proximal area, for instance, well, it will be very easy area to be infiltrated with this patient. Another patient that is maybe more efficient with the hygiene, maybe we will have more success. And what we don't know, maybe two patients with the same IgM level, very high IgM level, because of different bacterias, because of different states from the beginning. We had already on the patient A more bacterias in already, and patient B less, but this we don't know. So as we don't know from the beginning, it's so difficult to take the decision. And this is why I completely agree with Stefan. We can tell the patient with a lot of confidence, I really think that the tooth will not break further, but I don't know what will happen with the pulp or with the bone around that tooth. So let's just monitor it. And as soon as we have a problem, we can still make another decision and maybe replace it by an implant. But on the other hand, it will be completely crazy if it's my tooth. Having a dentist advise me, you know, at it's not a 100% guarantee. So you would better take out that tooth and replace it by an implant right now, because this is the 100% guarantee. I don't believe in this either. So completely agree with you, Stefan, on that.
The interesting thing is I kind of work in a high-end implant office. Actually, I now see cases where implants crack as well.
Yeah.
Well, so I mean, there's now 100%. Of course, implant is less likely to crack, for example. But for example, I mean, the screw inside can have a crack. The abutment can have problems. The whole implant itself can break. So it's always, people always tell me when that's a functional problem. You didn't look at the function probably, or the patient didn't look at the function. And probably one part of it, because we know that when the patient bites together, they apply more force on an implant than a natural vital teeth.
Exactly.
And of course, and that's also so a consideration. And when I see clinically my last 10 years, when I see cracked teeth, it's usually a lower 7 where there's no wisdom tooth. That's usually the main tooth who cracks.
That's it.
Yeah. I can totally also have the same conclusion. I see also, and I think it has been published, but I have to look up the publication, neighbor teeth of implant-supported crowns and bridges also suffer more, and opposing teeth from those implant-supported, especially crowns and bridges, and especially zirconia, they suffer much more than teeth that are functioning together with the natural tooth. So, yeah, implants are meant to replace missing teeth, not just teeth. I don't remember who said it, but
I think it's kind of, we should be aware that we are dentists, not implantists. But there's a trend in some areas where we just replace everything with an implant, which is not so nice from an endodontic point of view.
But even if we are not conservative dentists, I can understand very well the point of view of the implantologist. It's a very pragmatic point of view. For us, or European, we would say it's a very American point of view. It's kind of judgment already, so it's not good. But I would just say that this is maybe mainly imprudent. Maybe this is a very good treatment. But the problem is that, unfortunately, our patient will live much longer. They will come back at the office, and we will not retire at 50 years old. We will retire at 70, 75 years old. So the patient will come back to us again and again and again. What if we put implants already at 40 years old? What will we do at 60 years old, or 70 years old, or 18 years old? So I don't really think that it's like a war of between different philosophies and stuff. This is just like pretty evident. This is the safe way to treat teeth, to try to keep them in the mouth, because we are buying time. We don't know if we are right. We don't know if we will meet success for 100% of the treatment, but we are buying time. We have to maintain those patients till 90, 100 years. So it's like this philosophy of implant. Of course, we should not wait the very, very final state where there is no bone anymore to put implants. This doesn't make sense. But I think there is an in-between. So it's not only philosophy, it's just pure common sense. You know, we have to deal with patients for a very long time. We have to provide a service to them. So let's be conservative just for ourselves. This is a very selfish decision, you know, to sleep good at night. The dentist should be conservative. I think.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea to be a good conservative. It's kind of interesting that on some websites you see we are so modern, we practice modern dentistry, but being conservative with very old things like cuspal coverage and other things is the new normal, or hopefully the new normal.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I can tell that more and more I tell many people actually at some level where we might be going back to some principles of extension for prevention, where you extend the tooth preparation to be able to prevent further cracking by doing a cuspal coverage, by prepping a crown. It's some kind of level of extension for prevention. And it's very interesting to see how there's always like a pendulum movement and things are going back. Think about VertiPrep. It's not new. It's very popular now, but it's not new. It's old as...
as prosthetic dentistry, as old as prosthodontics.
But these things become, again, en vogue because of the real need, actually. And because of the different perspective on how teeth can be approached. Yeah, that keeps it pretty interesting. We will never be out of work and never be out of a job. And we will we'll need to revise our guidelines, our proposals, our strategies. We will need to revise them from time to time, for sure.
I mean, when it comes, for example, for a Verti crown, it's kind of interesting when we have a teeth who is also already partly cracked. I think it's a great option for these cases. When we have deep margins for sure, we can't place an onlay there. The margin elevation is not, doesn't have really a good foundation there. I think it's a great approach there, although I barely doing it because I'm mostly working in the direct.
No, but totally. There is no alternative that we should put on the side. It's interesting to have everything that we could do for the patient. Why not VertiCrowns or crowns? But basically, again, I think we should maybe look a little bit wider, further beyond the technique. VertiCrowns could be very good technique in some hands. And see, in some other hands, it could be just a disaster. So it's not about technique. If I learn something being by Stefan's side, is that basically what makes the difference is always the operator. And the way I could improve my practice, learning from Stefan and other people, for instance, is just by improving the fundamentals. The fundamentals is to see better. Better use microscopes and stuff like that, force myself to use high magnification and improve my practice of isolation, which is the base of the teaching of Stefan for years and years. And at the end, when you can improve this, it comes much, much before the decision of margin elevation, inlay, onlay, cuspal coverage, VertiPreps and stuff, you can see that you can do maybe a lot of different treatments because the base of the pyramid is completely assured and you can do it good. If you miss that, well, there is no sense to go further because whatever VertiPrep or overlay, it will not be properly done. So unfortunately, I understand that the people get more interested by a brand new technique or a brand new instrument, kind of magic stuff that will change your indication and your practice, that we always come to the very basic stuff. If we improve our practice in the fundamentals procedures, I think everything is open and any technique can be a good one. Amen.
Wisely spoken. Wisely spoken.
Sorry, I'm preaching now. Wow. I'm almost American.
Actually, my old professor always also told everyone, before you go to an implant curriculum, rather learn how to place a matrix.
Yeah.
And he was right.
No, it's true. The perfect example, Stefan, that you could explain is when people say, how about chasing cracks? I think the answer is not about chasing cracks. It is very easy to chase, you know. The problem is to seal it.
Yeah, exactly. And to decide whether or not to chase, and if you chase, up to what level, and then how to seal it, because so many elements will influence your final decision and the success. All things that we will develop in much more detail during the symposium lecture, of course.
I mean, the lecture will be 45 minutes.
Mm. Oh, no. Much more?
No.
More. Much more? Oh, yeah. We will have some bonuses for you.
Oh, that will be great. I didn't know that. I was told I only have with Mindaugas give about 45 minutes and that's it. That's probably because you used all the extra time.
Well, it's such a vast amount of information that we needed a little more than 45 minutes to make sense out of it. So otherwise, it would be just, you know, touch and take off again. So we want to offer more than just a teaser, so we have a little more time than 45 minutes.
We understood it was 45 minutes per person. So that's why we multiplicated the time per two at least.
Actually, it's quite a challenge to prepare an online lecture with someone else. I guess you both are more into it because you did so many lectures already together that it's much easier. That's kind of a challenge because even when it's being recorded online, so how are you going to do it? Will each one has a small topic, or will you talk all the same and record all at the same time?
Actually, it's something that we were thinking about prior to defining the final format of the presentation. Because if we have the pleasant experience of presenting together, even on the same, you know, stage or conferences, but during the same lecture, doing the duo lectures, we were feeling kind of, I don't know, triggered to do this also online. So it will be kind of a dialogue where there will be quite some interaction between the both of us, where one will try to ask the good questions, the other one will try to give the good answers, and vice versa. So it's quite interactive and dynamic in terms of approach, because it's, I think it's more lively, and I hope it represents also the questions that dentists might have when they tackle the topic of cracks. So we try to look at it from the dentist perspective, patient perspective, and then try to wrap everything up in an interactive, dynamic way.
I think we had so much discussion together about dental topics, including cracks, in the past with Stefan, but also with other colleagues. We just try to make from those conversation lectures, because this is the real way people are speaking together. This is how we learn from each other. It's like speaking, like having a beer and speaking in a bar, and they say, "Oh, I have had this problem today. How to fix it? I did that. It didn't work. What do you think? What do you do?" And actually, we did during those lectures that we did together, and it's completely true for the online version. What should it be different? We just decided to go for a very simple way. And I think this is always the best, because this is the most understandable for the people. This is how any human being is interacting with other human beings. So we're just trying to make it real and very simple.
I'm really looking forward for your lecture. I think everybody can be glad that they can watch it online and even re-watch it again. So before we come to an end, it's basically, have you ever done also workshops on this topic, and how would a workshop look? I mean, I kind of think that it's kind of difficult to produce cracks for a workshop and to seal them. It's not possible, probably.
I have done workshops where we use extracted teeth with cracks, and we use them with high magnification microscope, the D-Light Pro, and a plaque indicator to reveal some cracks you can see on those extracted teeth. You can use transillumination. There's a lot of things you can see on extracted teeth, but if you dismantle some of the extracted teeth with some amalgam, very likely you will find some cracks. So go ahead, find some extracted teeth with amalgams or older fillings, whatever, and you will find some. So yeah, there's some part of workshop you could do, but it's still limited to an extracted real tooth.
Yeah, because to organize those ends on, we just have to extract teeth. And then we don't want to do this.
Actually, there's a German company who sells extracted teeth, which is quite interesting.
I don't want to know where the teeth are coming from. I don't want to be involved to get involved.
I mean, it has like some strange pitch to it, but it's basically where we have in certain states of Germany, we have the regulation that teeth are not allowed to be thrown into the trash, into the regular trash. So there's a company who's just collecting all the extracted teeth and kind of takes care of it. And actually, they even have like the system that you can kind of buy teeth depending on the decay status, and you can even buy teeth which are completely untouched, which is crazy.
Okay, so actually, and this is Germany made, huh? It's very valuable, then it's, and it's, so you know that it comes from your neighbor, maybe. Interesting.
Probably. I mean, it's also in Berlin where I live. It's the company is kind of there. But for example, when I had an endodontic curriculum and needed 6 really good extracted molars, I basically didn't find them because just the week before, all the dentist's office in Berlin, there was like the collection time kind of. Mm-hmm. After I called them, I just got the 6 teeth I needed, and it was quite convenient.
Very good.
No question asked.
No questions asked.
You just pay the bill silently.
Exactly.
Okay. So thanks for your time, guys. I really appreciate it. I hope to see you online at the GC November Symposium.
Absolutely. Thank you.
We promise. Thank you. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for having us.
It was great. Thank you. Thank you, guys.
Bye.
Bye.